Yes, okay.
Already I called the meeting to order and Herb is the Herb did Herb show up? Oh, here it is. Okay, Herb. Let's start. You can start with the pledge of the flag. Now everybody stand. Go ahead, Herb.
Pledge allegiance.
Sorry, I got halfway through and realized I was muted. I pledge
allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and
justice for all.
All right, be seated. Roll call.
Just waiting for Legislator Waro to connect. There we are. Okay. Archer.
Here.
Bartels.
Here.
Bruno.
Here.
Cahill.
Here.
Corcoran.
Here.
Criswell. DeLon. Donaldson.
Here.
Fabiano. Gavaris.
Present.
Green.
Yes. Here.
Haynes.
Here.
Heppner.
Here.
Litz.
Here.
Lopez. Mayo. Parity. Petit.
Here.
Roberts. Ronk. Uchitel.
Here.
Walter.
Here.
And Waro.
Here.
15 present, 8 absent. Chairman Donaldson, this is your special informational meeting. I'll turn it over to you.
All righty. So I will let you guys take over. And you can, will you be able to share the screen, I think? Is that correct? Or do you need that?
Tom, are you going to work that?
Yeah, I'm going to share my screen and show the presentation.
Okay.
All right.
Can everyone see this?
Yeah.
Yep.
Can you get rid of the stuff around it? Yeah, there you go. Okay. Want to go to the first slide? Okay. Well, I'm going to start this. I'm Margaret Guarino, Managing Director of CMA in charge of the Strategic Advisory Group. I want to thank Chairman Donaldson and the dedicated members of the County Legislature, the members of the Ways and Means Committee, members of the legislative staff, especially and primarily Amber Fester and Natalie Kedler, because we couldn't do this without them. We also want to show our appreciation and commend the cooperation of the county executive, his administrative staff, the staff members of key departments we've interviewed. As I said last year, and I will say it again, in our business, many, many times it's hard to get department heads and the administration to cooperate because we're going into intensive interviews. And we were surprised last year, and I certainly appreciate this year that cooperation. The members of my team are on. There's myself. There's Tom Voussakis, who is running this slideshow. There is James Nyko and Leonard Bernard. So they've worked hard on this, and I appreciate everything they've done also. Tonight, we're here to discuss the findings in respect to our review and analysis of the proposed 2022 budget. This is something we feel very strongly about, and we know that we work for both you and the county stakeholders, and this engagement is near and dear to us. We take it very seriously. I'm a taxpayer in Ulster County, and James grew up in the neighboring Dutchess County. So we have a lot personally involved in this. The engagement details are the following. Originally, we were commissioned by the legislature in September 2020. This marks our second review of the county's budget. Many unique considerations went into this report because of the continued impact of COVID-19. We successfully adapted this approach, and we account for this throughout this report. Now to discuss the report, the approach, I'm sorry, I'm going to turn it over to Tom.
Thanks, Margaret. So as Margaret mentioned, having done this report last year and speaking with most of the department heads and some of the same folks, let us get a quicker start this year than starting from scratch. To do so, we took into account a number of things. First, obviously, this year's budget. But we also looked at the previous year's budgets, the county's audits, any resolutions or press releases put out by this body, and then documents of other governments to benchmark, and any best practice publications from GFOA or the like. That gave us our baseline, but to get a better understanding of the county's operations, and even more so than we might have last year, we once again spoke with a number of the key department heads to find out what was the driving factors behind any of the numbers in the budget, how they approached going into next year, things of that nature. We also spoke with other jurisdictions, other neighboring counties. CMA's financial advising practice has over 400 clients in New York State, so we have a wealth of knowledge to derive a better understanding from. So we certainly took that into account as we were speaking to department heads and looking through any of the documents that were available to us. Now, of course, the biggest obstacle for the county putting together the budget, as well as us in reviewing the budget, was how to take into account the ongoing pandemic. We've all probably gotten used over the last 18 months to a number of different ways of living, but it's hard to really tell how that's going to impact the coming fiscal year from the county's point of view. Any kind of continued disruptions, obviously there's a lot of supply chain shortages going on right now, some inflationary pressure that could impact supply costs, wages, things like that, and any potential resurgence of cases through mutations like the Delta variant or things of the like that we wanted to be cognizant of, and we felt that the county should be cognizant of going into next year. So once we had all the documents in our baseline and we had some obstacles that we were going through, we had to decide how to approach going through the budget review and putting together this report. One of the first things we did was a trend analysis, looking at previous actuals, previous budgets of the county, and how we would expect them to trend based on historical data. Benchmarking against the county's peers, other counties in the state, and then how the county has performed versus their budget in prior years. So one of the first things that we looked at was the revenue side. And as I mentioned, a big factor in this was how much to take into account the COVID-19 pandemic, primarily because it's so far outside of the county's control. So whenever we were discussing revenues with department heads, with county administrators, we always felt that it was safer to err on the side of conservatism and caution when planning for any types of revenues going into next year. And we certainly took that into account when putting together our report. Now, this also brings about an opportunity because of the federal stimulus monies that have been flowing to the county and will continue at least through the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021. The county's received one tranche already and will receive its second tranche sometime next year. So how it utilizes those funds is going to speak a lot to how 2022 and the ensuing years go. To speak about the rest of the revenues, I'm going to turn it over to Len Bernard.
Thank you. That last point on that last slide, to limit risk of developing structurally imbalanced budgets, revenues should remain conservative as possible. Very important. When you overestimate revenues in a budget, obviously, and underestimate expenses, it leads to bad budgeting and disaster. So revenues, it's very important to budget revenues accurately. So what I want to talk about first, sales tax. Sales tax is one of the uncertain revenues in your budget. It's the largest source of revenue in your budget. This year, or in the 22 proposed budget, it is $143 million, or 41.29% of the overall revenue in the budget. So it accounts for a large portion of your revenue. That $143 million represents about a 19% increase over what was in the budget in 2021. That's a very substantial increase and something that gave us a little pause. Your 10-year average percentage of total budget for sales tax is about 35.5%. So 41.3% is quite a large jump. Going from $120 million in your 21 budget to $143 million in your 22 budget, again, is about a 19% increase. And again, a very large jump and something that should be looked at very, very carefully. Sales tax is a very uncertain revenue for several reasons. Number one, sales tax is dependent upon consumer demand. It's dependent upon the economy. It's dependent upon demand for products. Right now, as you know, economic growth has slowed down in the last quarter to about 2%. We have supply chain problems in this country right now with respect to getting product to commercial establishments. All of these things create risk. And also, you know, create risk in terms of the ability to collect sales tax. We're not sure that $143 million is the right amount for next year. If you look at the trends over the last 10 years in sales tax collection in the county, the most the county received in any given year was a little over $127 million. To go from $127 million to $143 million, again, a big jump. The most sales tax increased in any given year over the last 10 years was about 6%. So again, you're talking about a year-to-year increase of 6%, but you're talking about a year-to-year increase now in 2022 of 19%. Again, gives you pause. 2022 projection based on a 10-year trend should not be $143 million. It should be much less. If you base your 2022 projection on the last several months, because the last several months collections have been up, perhaps. But again, do you want to risk next year's estimate based on the last 3 months, or do you want to base it on the last 10 years? The literature, which in the detailed report you'll see, we have a very extensive section on the economic literature, which talks about the uncertainty right now in the economy, which could affect your sales tax collection. So bottom line is that we're recommending that the sales tax number, the projection for 2022 be looked at and maybe be moderated a little bit, $3 to $4 million. We feel more comfortable with that. And again, like I said, you do not want to overestimate revenue because once you do, creates problems, creates an unstructured budget, actually. Next item is real property taxes. As you know, there's a state-imposed real property tax cap of 2%. We recommend that, and I think we recommended this in last year's report also, that the county adopt a resolution which would allow them to pierce that 2% real property tax cap. Again, we don't think that it will be needed, but what it shows is a willingness to raise property taxes if needed. I talked about this yesterday. You really can't cut off property tax as a revenue. If you look at the trend in the county over the last 10 years, real property tax hasn't increased at all year to year. And again, you can't just dismiss sales tax out of hand. Sales tax is one of your bigger revenues, about $81 million in the 2022 proposed budget. Again, that's not much of an increase over the, in fact, I think it's a slight decrease over 2021 and in line with what has happened over the last 10 years. So, again, real property tax, 81 million, which is 23% of your overall revenues. You have to allow yourself at least the opportunity to talk about raising it in the future. Again, we think you should pass the resolution, which would allow you to pierce the tax cap in 2022, even though you probably won't need to. But again, that shows a willingness to raise property taxes. It's a good sign. It's a good signal to send out to the rating agencies, because one of the things they look at is a municipality's willingness to increase their revenue streams. And again, this is one of your bigger revenue streams. So again, we think that the recommendation here is to pass that resolution, showing that you are willing to be flexible on property tax collection. Okay, the next is state and federal aid. This is another uncertain revenue. As you know, a large portion of your revenues come from state and federal aid. In the 2022 proposed budget, over $88 million is projected in state and federal aid. This is about the same level as 2021. So it's a fairly conservative estimate. But one thing you have to keep in mind moving forward is that federal and state aid are subject to many uncertainties. As we all know, the federal and state budgets are always very controversial, and they go in terms of revenue, in terms of grants, in terms of local aid, you know, what they vote in, they can vote out. Political winds certainly have an impact on state and federal aid also. So one of the things that we are recommending here is that the projection or the amount in the 22 budget remain where it is, not be increased during your deliberations. We think it's a good number, but of course, during the budget year 2022, you should closely monitor the flow of aid to make sure that the projected amounts are being received. And if they are not, or if there are any cutbacks mid-year, you certainly should adjust your budget accordingly. Next one. Hotel occupancy tax. Now, this is a tax that the county has control over. It's something that I believe the county legislature has discussed in the past. I did a little research and found that there has been discussion in committee on the issuance of an occupancy tax. It hasn't been done, but quite frankly, we think it's one area where you could substantially increase your yearly revenue without having to increase sales tax or property tax. Your rate of occupancy tax, the rate that the county charges, is 2%, which is about half the amount that most neighboring counties charge, and it's about half the state average for counties. So there is room there for you to increase the rate. Obviously, if you were to go from 2%, which is your current rate, to the market rate of 4%, you could actually double your revenue. Next year, the projection is $2.8 million for occupancy tax. If you were to increase the rate, obviously you can increase that number. If you were to double the rate, you would double that number if that $2.8 million is a good projection, which we think it is. Now, one of the issues, obviously, is if you increase the rate, what impact would it have on the hospitality industry? Not sure that the rate is going to have that much of an impact on demand for accommodations. There are other factors certainly that would impact that more, like the economy, which of course is always a uncertain factor, certainly something that could impact. Might be a good idea to think about maybe gradually increasing.
Can I put something in there?
It might be wise to maybe think about increasing the occupancy tax or the rate for the occupancy tax gradually over time to see what impact it does have on the hospitality industry. Again, I think the only impact it's going to have is that you're just going to increase the amount of money you collect versus what you would have collected by keeping it at a lower rate. So to me, in a lot of ways, this one is a no-brainer, at least to take a look at and think about raising it gradually over time. And like I said earlier, there's the possibility where you could actually increase your revenue between $2 and $3 million. So next slide, departmental revenues. This is the smallest segment of your revenues. In the 2022 budget, it's about $10.5 million, which is about 3% of your overall revenue. Again, COVID could impact some of these departmental charges, but again, we're not talking about a large number here. The amount in the budget for this year, the $10.5 million, is actually a little bit higher than the average amount that has been collected over the last 5 years. So what we're recommending here is that you take another look at it, and you may want to moderate the amount in the budget for 2022. And that's really it for the revenues. I think James is going to take over on the expenditures at this point.
Excellent. Thank you, Len. Yes, I'm going to discuss the expenditure section of our report. As you're probably aware, the 22 proposed budget of the county includes total appropriations expenses of about $351 million. Now, similar to the revenue section of our report, the methodology we utilized looking at the expenditures was very similar. We utilized trend analyses, benchmark analyses. We looked at some expenditure variance reports. That's essentially the budget to actuals and a number of different financial ratios. Unfortunately, and as Tom had mentioned, we're still in a world where COVID is active. Maybe it's not as intensive a concern as it was last year because we have it's coming into a little bit of a sharper focus now, but it does continue to be out there, and it's causing some unknown factors and some of those factors are outside of the direct control of the county. And those could have a significant impact on really the revenue side of the budget. Nevertheless, we feel that expenditures are a little bit more easy to control than the revenue side. You can strategically increase your expenditures to match revenues, particularly in 22, if things start to develop unfavorably. Next slide, Tom. So one of the areas that we looked at was generally personnel. As is common with any municipal jurisdiction, the services provided by the county are extremely labor intensive, and as a result, wages and benefits account for a significant portion of the county's annual recurring expenditures. In fact, it's about 27% or so of the 22 proposed budget relates to regular part-time, overtime, and contractual pays alone. Another 17.6 goes to pay that's relating to health insurance, Social Security, workers' compensation, retirement, and unemployment. So overall, regular pay comes in at about 13.3%, and that's between the adopted 21 budget and the proposed 22 budget. That's an increase. Although some of the increase in the pay is attributable to the recently settled contracts with the employees, particularly CSEA. A portion is also attributable to about 59 positions which have been included and added to the 2022 budget. We looked at this using a conservative 50% of salaries to calculate potential future benefit costs. The estimated expense for these benefits for the 59 positions is about $1.7 million, bringing the total estimate for those salaries plus benefits for those 59 positions to about $5.3 million for the first year, with contractual increases likely in future years. We feel that the county should carefully review the creation of these 59 positions with the goal of only funding those positions that are deemed to be essential and to only fund them when those positions are necessary. So, and I think we kind of covered some of this already, but, you know, as far as the labor contracts right now, we just feel that it's appropriate to really monitor them. You know, we did a year-to-date review of those, and it seems that up to this point in 2021, they're appropriately funded. And the county executive notes that there's no funds that have been budgeted for the settlement contracts. That's, you know, kind of creates an area for risk in the budget. Ignoring the impact of employee contract settlements in future years, you know, could potentially build a deficit into the budget. So we just wanted to bring that to the county's attention. So the overtime, budgeting for overtime, it's always very difficult. It's a difficult task while also trying to control staffing costs and the impact of those costs over the yearly operations and the services that are required to be provided by the county. You know, particularly with the COVID-19 pandemic, it's made budgeting for overtime, you know, exceptionally more difficult than it had been in prior years. We have some detail in the report, and I would, you know, recommend that you go and review it. The exhibit is on the screen here. It's exhibit EXP-6. And I'm going to maybe turn this over to Len for a moment, and he can talk a little bit more about the analysis that we conducted as it relates to overtime in the budget.
Yeah, I was looking at the most recent variance reports, and I noticed that there were a lot of overtime lines that seemed to be under budgeted at the beginning of the year, that required budget modifications during the year. And I think that it indicated to me that overtime wasn't being totally budgeted properly or fully. I found 11 lines that really need to be looked at again in terms of the way they're budgeted for 2022. Because if you look, you'll see that the actual, and what I did was I did a little calculation and created a formula. So I took the 2020 amount, the actual amount spent on overtime. Then I took the amount currently in the budget, the amended amount, and averaged the two, and then added 5%, which would account for any raise and any increase in salaries and longevity, and then came up with a number that 2022 should be used for 2022. And I did that for, now that 11 lines may not sound much, but there, you know, they're, overall there's 49 lines that are budgeted at over $1,000. So 11 lines, that's 22% of the overtime lines. So it's pretty significant. Some of these lines are actually pretty big. And I think I give an example in the report where one line was budgeted for zero in 2020. The budget mod was done. Almost $15,000 was spent on the line. And then in 2021, the line was budgeted for zero again, and another amendment had to be done for almost $9,000. And most of that $9,000 has already been used in 2021. In the 2022 budget, zero is budgeted again. So, I mean, it's an indication that, you know, either it's not an important line for someone or it's something that should be looked at. And again, that is probably the most extreme example, but there are others where substantial amendments were done and then the budget for 2022 doesn't really reflect it. Now, there may be in isolated or individual cases a reason for that. There may be a one-off expense that may be covered or a project, But overall, like I said, 66 overtime lines altogether, 49 of which are budgeted for over $1,000, then, you know, found that over 20% of them really need to be looked at again to make sure that moving forward, they're budgeted properly. And again, I would recommend that maybe somebody take a look at all of the overtime lines that have over $1,000 in them just to make sure that the 2022 amounts are appropriate. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Len. Tom, you can go to the next slide. So purchase orders, the use of purchase orders and the encumbrances they create, it's an important budget monitoring tool and really a management tool as well. When a PO is created, the money needed to pay for an item or for a service being contracted for is encumbered or frozen, and thus can only be really used for that purpose, for the purpose of the purchase order. Using a PO or an encumbrance, it's a valuable tool, and if it ensures that the budget's going to adhere to a certain line, it's not going to be overspent, and the budgeted funds are going to be spent only on the items that, you know, that they're required to be spent for. Now, a lot of the times when we're conducting reviews like this, we look at, you know, best practices, you know, the different associations, what do they say about things like this? And one of the primary entities that we look at is an entity called the Government Finance Officers Association. And they recommend utilizing purchase cards as an efficient alternative to purchase orders for, you know, similar small or high volume purchases. And we believe that the county should review its purchase orders and its encumbrances to ensure that the budgeted funds are only utilized for their intended purposes, that they're identified for in the budget, and that the lines are not overspent. You know, as we've indicated a couple times, you know, we did conduct focus interviews with, you know, various departments of the county, and we felt that, you know, the county staff would likely agree with that recommendation. So the budget variance reports, you know, for the purposes of the review this year, what we had done is we actually created a full section of the report that's dedicated to this. And what we wanted to showcase with that was, you know, you could see this variance report with the revenues followed, you know, directly by, you know, by the expenditures. And I think, you know, kind of tells a bit of a story. We did a 5-year analysis that covers, you know, generally all of the governmental funds. You know, the findings for the revenue side suggests that, you know, several sources of revenue in those governmental funds have historically been under budgeted. In the most two recent years, 2019 and 2020, the negative variance for revenues increased, you know, rather significantly, which particularly in 2020 is understandable in light of the COVID-19, you know, pandemic and the economic impact that unfortunately it had around the nation. The findings for the expenditure sharply contrasted those of the revenues. For each of the last 5 years, 2016 through 2020, the completed audited years, the sum variance for those were always positive. And they were, you know, relatively by $20 million, $15 million, except for 2020. You know, that positive variance jumped up to about $38.9 million. You know, those small variance would be appropriate in a budget. You want to make sure that there's sufficient, you know, room built in. A disproportionate positive expenditure variance, you know, can suggest that there may be a little bit too much padding in the budget. So we just wanted to make sure that we pointed out, you know, that relatively large increase, particularly in light of, you know, the trend. So it's typical, you know, we've seen the under budgeting of the revenue. So you'll see a lot of red in that area. But on the expenditure side, it's just, it's, you know, quite different. So fund balance, you know, during our review of the 2020 budget, we concluded that the county, you know, really kind of depends on a lot of different types of revenue that can be sensitive to fluctuations in the economy. As Len had indicated before, your primary source of revenue being sales tax is, you know, extremely volatile, and, you know, can be changed dramatically. The other two sources that Len had indicated in this fashion were, you know, both state and federal aid, which accounted for, you know, roughly 25 to 30% of the budget. So those are not sometimes reliable sources. And they can be impacted by a number of things. Obviously, the pandemic, as we've all unfortunately have seen, you know, can impact that changes to the climate, severe weather damages, you know, even political actions that are happening in Albany and at the federal level can have significant impacts on, you know, what gets budgeted for those sources year to year. So as a result, we felt that, you know, kind of viewing the fund balance, it's extremely important to take kind of those items into consideration. So therefore, we believe that the county should perhaps be looking at utilizing a less appropriation of fund balance in the general fund for the 2022 proposed budget year. Of note, though, you know, the 22 budget does include a smaller appropriation of fund balance as compared to the 2021 budget. The county's fund balance policy, which was recently adopted this past September, we felt should be reevaluated to address budgetary appropriations during fiscally challenging economic times. And again, going back to talking about some of those factors that that I previously discussed, the pandemic, climate changes, all of those different areas which could have, you know, severe and significant impacts on some of those economically sensitive revenue sources. So debt, you know, the issuance of debt is very important. It's a very important revenue source for the county. It's, you know, how it funds different projects, purchases. It's equally important to strategically utilize that power to make sure that you're moving in the correct and the right directions. And, you know, that's really why, you know, the state, and there's several state and federal laws which kind of oversee how you're able to issue debt, setting parameters around it, things of that nature. In the 2022 budget, the sum total of long-term bonded debt, short-term note debt, and if we include authorized but unissued debt, it's close to $250 million. Now, that's, again, I'm not, that number is not what's actually outstanding. If you look on the screen here, you'll see the net indebtedness right now as of October 25th, and that's prior to debt that's currently being issued, is about $102 million. Regardless, those are very, very large numbers. And we feel very strongly that as a result of that, of the importance of debt and those numbers, that it's important that the county consider crafting and perhaps adopting a debt management policy. You can go to the next slide, Tom. The cash flow borrowings.
Is there a way to ask a question while we're on a specific topic, Chairman? Anyway,
let them go through, Lynn, and then we'll go back and I'll call on you first. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. So cash flow borrowings. The county doesn't currently issue any cash flow borrowings. What we're talking here is, something called a tax anticipation note or a revenue anticipation note. Those are utilized in instances when there's, you know, perhaps a gap in your finances. You need to kind of bridge through a portion of the year. What the county does do is they annually adopt both a tax anticipation note resolution and a revenue anticipation note resolution, which would allow you to go into the debt markets to borrow if you needed to. You know, we feel that is a fine practice, because if something happens and something develops very unfavorably during 2022, you're able to, you know, kind of quickly go in and do that. So it's not that the county's issuing for those obligations, but, you know, it affords them ability to jump in the market rather quickly if necessary. So we felt that was a fine practice. The upcoming issuance of debt, I do believe that the county had issued a series of bond anticipation notes and also a series of serial bonds earlier this morning. Those were priced. They have not closed yet. You know, as you can see on the screen here, the closing is tentatively scheduled for November 17th. Since that date is going to occur, prior to the adoption of the resolution, you know, with the pricing today, the county should understand what the impact would be of those obligations on its finances in 2022. And by that, I mean the principal payments that will be required, the interest rates that they were sold at, which generate, you know, the amount of interest. So we just wanted to make certain that for the adopted budget, those actual numbers get placed into the budget. So it's, you know, right now what's in there is really, you know, just an estimate. So we just want to make sure that for the adopted budget, it reflects the actual payments that the debt was priced at. The capital improvement plan, we have a large section of the report, you know, kind of dedicated to the capital improvement plan. Over the period 2017 through 2021, spending in the capital improvement plan has been relatively stable until recently. You know, by comparison to those prior years, 2022 shows a significant increase of about 53.24%, and that's just we're comparing it to 2021. There's some charts and some graphs that you'll see in there, which, you know, kind of give you a visual representation of that. So we'd recommend that you know, kind of go through and look at that in the report. We also felt that, you know, some of the charts, you know, could be made a little bit more clear in the plan itself. There are, you know, summary tables in the beginning, which are excellent. It kind of breaks it out, you know, very well what, you know, what the programs are going to be funding, what their uses are. What seems to be lacking, and I believe this was a recommendation from the report last year, is the funding source. It's in the detail of the document. It's certainly there. We just felt like including it in the summary information up front might be helpful. And a good addition to that capital improvement plan. Another big area that we wanted to discuss is the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021. I'm sure at this point, you know, many folks on this call are aware of what that plan is, but it's federal funding as a result of the COVID pandemic. The county does have an allocation under this plan, so under the ARPA, county's allocation of funding is, you know, about $34.5 million. There's a lot of rules and parameters around the ARPA funds. The funding is subject to requirements that are specified by the United States Treasury in their interim final rules. The key word there is interim. The rules have not been set in stone yet at this point. The interim rules were adopted this past May. So they're still relatively new, and a lot of folks are trying to digest it. It's a very large document, and it's, you know, parts of it are rather confusing. We were hoping that the Treasury would be finalizing those rules at some point, you know, in the fall. We had originally heard perhaps September, perhaps October. Here we are, November. They have not, you know, yet been finalized. So it's important just to keep in mind that, you know, although there's these very significant rules surrounding the program, they're still interim at this point. One of the key things that's identified in those rules is the eligible uses for those funds. They're not, you know, free funds that can essentially be utilized on any so purpose that the county, you know, wishes to use them on. They need to be spent on very specific areas. Some of those areas include, you know, support of public health expenditures, addressing the negative economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, the ability to replace lost revenue, providing premium pay to essential workers, and investing in certain types of infrastructure, primarily water, sewer, and broadband. One thing that we would bring to, you know, to the county's attention is there is some federal legislation that is, you know, kind of being kicked around right now. It passed the House, has not yet passed the Senate, but it would kind of broaden some of the rules surrounding these ARPA funds, in particular, infrastructure and the types of infrastructure projects that those ARPA funds could essentially be utilized for. Now, it's important, again, to remember that there's, you know, really significant and strict requirements around these funds. I think with the ARPA funds, one of the end goals is to make sure that, you know, the Treasury doesn't ever come back and, you know, try to claw funds back if they're utilized in an incorrect or improper fashion. It's certainly, you know, a possibility that something like that could occur. So we caution the county, you know, the inappropriate use of those funds on an ineligible project or cost could result in a clawback by the Treasury. And that would obviously have a very significant and direct impact, negative impact on the county's finances. So the recommendations that we have, you know, directly surrounding these funds but that the county should really spend some time to develop a comprehensive understanding of the U.S. Treasury's interim final rules. Again, they're very complex and they're very confusing. We felt that it's important for the county to continually monitor its revenues, which they have been, but they need to continually monitor to see, you know, what is the effect of the pandemic? You know, obviously it's still here, a couple of years later, and it's having some significant impacts on the economy. So understanding those impacts are certainly important. Avoiding, you know, utilizing those funds to pay for projects that, you know, may have a long-term financial commitment, essentially a tail, really more of a best practice, but it's something that, you know, we actually provide some consulting services for a few clients on ARPA-related monies, and one of the first things that we always, you know, say is don't ever fund anything, you know, with a tail. You don't want to see that you're putting yourself in a worse position once those funds run out a couple of years down the line than you are today. So that's very important. And, you know, important for the county to plan for the best and most strategic use of those ARP funds and their allocations. And with that, I'm going to hand this back over to Margaret.
We did this slide, so go to the next slide. Yeah. Well, in conclusion, we feel very strongly that the finances, the findings, and the initiatives identified in our 2022 review will assist the county to develop sustainable financial operations. If key recommendations that we have detailed in this review were to be initiated by the county, CMA believes the net impact to be in the range of about $3.5 million. That is a financial impact, but we also know that there are other recommendations we made that if you adhere to them, we feel very strongly that the county would remain in a sustainable financial condition. And we thank you for this opportunity. We hope that this is a report that you can utilize and that we have done the job you asked us to do. So again, Chairman and everyone else, thank you very much.
Thank you. And with the questions, if you don't mind, Lynn, I just want to ask one quick question and you can get yourself together for questions, okay? The ARP money that we are looking at and what we've done is we're going to have three employees overseeing all of this, all that type of spending. And I'm curious as to what your opinion on that and what it is, how it's done in other places, shall we say.
Absolutely. I think I can answer that question, Chairman. So everybody's kind of handling this in different fashions. We've seen some jurisdictions are, you know, putting together full task force, which will, you know, come together and make recommendations that will go to, you know, governing board or whatever the case may be. We have seen some jurisdictions have brought staff in specific to work on, you know, ARPA and its related, you know, parameters or whatever you want to call them. A lot of places have brought in consultants. I think one of the benefits of bringing in consulting, you know, teams is they're not limited to just, you know, what's going on in your municipality. You know, generally a lot of these consulting firms, whether, you know, it's a firm like ours or a firm, an accounting firm, they're probably, you know, working with other jurisdictions as well. So it kind of opens that up. And I can tell you just from our experience, you know, we participate, you know, pretty frequently in webinars that are hosted by different associations, you know, GFOA, the New York Conference of Mayors, you know, the United States Conference of Mayors. And it's interesting because a lot of the times these conversations develop and, you know, between the different municipal officials and, well, we're looking at something this way, we're looking at it that way. And, you know, that can be, you know, very valuable. So I'd say it's a combination of both things. One thing I can, you know, bring to your attention is, you know, earlier this morning, Orange County released an RFP for various types of consultants to work on the ARP funds. The key thing is, there's a lot of rules surrounding these monies, and they really need to be understood. So you want to make certain that, that those are, because it's, there is a risk. If you're funding things that are not eligible to be funded with these monies, you don't want to be in a position where the Treasury comes knocking on the door, a couple of years down the line. There's a lot of reporting requirements. I didn't mention this during the presentation, but this is going to be something that's being monitored. So there was an interim report that was filed by the county. That was the first report, and that was this past August. August 31st was that report. Now, moving forward, the county is going to be required to file quarterly reports. The first quarterly report was supposed to be filed October 31st. However, because, and this is just my assumption, I think there's a widespread misunderstanding of this program. I think a lot of jurisdictions don't fully understand it. The Treasury moved that date back.
Yeah.
So the quarterly reports now, your first report's not going to be due until January 31st of 2022. After that, moving forward, you'll be required to file quarterly reports. Now, those quarterly reports, they're going to be expenditure reports. They're going to want to know really kind of two things. What have you obligated, meaning, what projects have you passed a resolution saying you're going to fund or, contracted for, and what have you actually spent those monies on? We haven't had to file them yet, so, we're not fully certain what they're going to be looking at, in those reports. But, generally, that's going to be it. And if you're giving money perhaps to other organizations, local small businesses to try to stimulate them, other organizations, be very careful with that. Because one of the other key things to remember with these monies is when you give funds to somebody else, they become a sub-recipient. The county is the recipient, but those other organizations become a sub-recipient. The county remains on the hook for those funds. So if those funds are utilized incorrectly or improperly and the county's not monitoring the use of those funds, you could find yourself in a much worse position. So
James, would you recommend that the county enter into contracts with anyone, written contracts that cover issues like that, to ensure that the monies are spent properly?
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. The clients that we represent for ARPA, they're kind of handling it in two ways. We have some folks that are, utilizing what we call an intake form, and that's kind of information gathering. Because when you're dealing with an outside organization, the minute that you start talking to them, you should really be gathering information on them. Treasury is pretty clear that you need very detailed files on this. So from minute one, you should be detailing those conversations. So
excuse me, Jay. For some of our clients, we've actually developed a intake form that will become part of the permanent record. So if the federal government comes and questions the use of anything, we have the record of what the money is going to be used for. And as Len said, in a contract, that the contract is very detailed and puts them on the hook if there is the possibility of a clawback. So those are all things you have to consider when it comes to ARPA funds. Go ahead, James.
We've seen other clients, kind of supplementing like intake forms with an actual agreement. That would be something that would need to be, reviewed by a legal team, your in-house legal counsel or somebody else. But we've seen that as well. And as Margaret had kind of mentioned, you're able to utilize these monies for outside organizations, not necessarily just for grants, but you can make loans to them. So we've seen some folks, considering the idea of using forgivable loans for their subrecipients, because what that does is it gives you make sure that there's a vested interest on them, giving you what you need to then complete your reports to the Treasury. And God forbid they utilize, monies in an improper fashion, it keeps the county not on the hook. Now, the other thing to consider, and I know I'm kind of throwing a lot of information out there about this, but There's spending requirements surrounding these funds as well, but you have plenty of time to spend the money. You have to obligate the funds by the end of 2024, December 31, 2024. So again, obligated means you're in a contract with somebody, you've passed a resolution saying we're using it for X, Y, or Z, and then the monies have to be officially spent by the end of 2026. Any money's not spent at that point, have to go back to the Treasury. But the key thing is, you have time here. So it's not that you have to race out and spend these funds. You can take your time, sit back, think strategically, and make certain that the monies are being spent in eligible areas and that you're not risking the potential for a clawback 2, 3, 4, 10 years down the line from now when the Treasury gets through actually looking at all of these different reports that are being filed.
I think the comptroller had a question. I saw it pop up on the screen.
Would you recommend that Ulster County file for lost revenues to buffer us from any ineligible ARPA, any projects or spending that's found to be ineligible?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Have your other clients made such filings?
Of course.
Yes.
From this point on, I will call on people with...
I'm sorry.
Otherwise, it's just going to get out of control.
Sorry.
If it's doing through chats and all that. So anyway, Lynn, I think you were the first person that wanted to go. And then I see Nana and Jonathan.
Just a couple of follow-up questions, if I could, James. On the debt policy, you said that you had a couple of recommendations on how to tighten up our policy and give us a little more wiggle room. So were those included in your package? Because I haven't gotten through the whole thing.
There was not like a sample debt management policy. There wasn't anything like that was in there.
Okay.
It was just a recommendation that, it's our understanding that there really is not a formalized policy in place. And they're really at this, there should be. That was
I think one of the things that I think it's mentioned somewhere. It's not listed as a recommendation, but in your authorized but unused category of debt, you have a chart that's in the capital plan, and I believe it's going to wind up being in your budget. Right now, there's a blank page there, but you have authorized but unused debt authorization. Some of those authorizations are like 7 and 8 years old. So one thing that any future debt management policy should contain is some kind of provision where you sunset some of these old authorizations that aren't being used.
Is there a value? I could never figure out. I've asked this question of the Commissioner of Finance and have never gotten a straight answer on this. Is there a value to keeping that unused debt in your balance sheets? I'm trying to understand why isn't it claimed?
I've been a town board member and I've been a finance commissioner, and my answer to that is no. something that's 7 or 8 years old, it really is unfair to the current elected officials because they weren't around when those projects were probably even discussed, and to come back and say to them, hey, you know what, we're going to go do this now, and you're sitting there saying, well, wait a second, I know nothing about this. Well, it was discussed and it was debated and an authorization was done, and that authorization is still good. So you should go back periodically and review those outstanding authorizations and decide whether or not the projects are still viable and whether or not there's still something you want to pursue. And if they're not, you should do a resolution basically taking back the authorization.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. That's helpful. And one of the things that we had talked about was potentially using, and this goes back to the whole ARP piece as well, potentially looking at what we have in outstanding debt and looking to see if we could pay that down with ARP money. Is that a viable option or not?
Absolutely
okay.
Not. There's very few limitations, that they put right out there. Those limitations are you cannot put the money into any types of fund balance, cannot pay debt service or even issuance costs, surrounding debt service. You can't fund pension costs. There's a handful of things, but it's pretty clear that would not, you know, be an eligible use of the funds.
Okay. And my final question, did you look at the proposals in the budget for how ARP money was being proposed to use? And was there anything in that that raised a flag in your mind?
We didn't do a line by line of, okay, you know, how those monies at this point are going to be utilized. I just think with the, you know, the timing surrounding the report itself, it just, we wouldn't have had the time to, you know, to really try to qualify each of those projects to make certain, you know, that they fit the eligible criteria.
Okay.
But James, you did do it.
Excuse me, Len. But if you have hired three people, or the administration has, they should go through that. Or if you hire a consultant, the consultant should go through that. But you should make sure it's correct.
And
so
what would be a cost on the consultant for doing this, you think?
It would vary. It would vary. One thing I can tell you is that it is an eligible expense of the ARPA funds. You can utilize the ARPA funds to pay costs relating to consultants to make certain that, you know, you're not going down the wrong direction.
Yeah, it would depend on the role of the consultant. You know, we have in another city, we have complete role. We're involved in everything, putting the form, developing the forms, putting the forms together. We developed a portal for them so it's transparent to the public. We're doing soup to nuts. That's one. Then there are others that we're just like overseeing the decisions they're making, and we're not as involved, but we're just making sure that adhering to the rules and everything. That's entirely different. So it really depends.
It depends what your need is. You know, I've seen other folks that are out there that, you know, seem to have some understanding of the program, and maybe they don't need that eligibility kind of criteria, the planning component of it, but they need to understand the accounting side of it. So maybe they'll have an accounting group. We've seen, you know, clients that have both of those things. You know, they have a team that comes in and helps them to understand kind of the big picture of the funds and how they can impact. And then they also have an accounting firm to come in because, you know, there's very different, you know, kind of things at play here. And an accountant may not be, you know, good at doing other aspects, where a planner is good at planning and kind of, you know, making certain that you're, you know, utilizing eligible costs and things of that nature. So there's, you know, we've seen, you know, very different things.
All right, I'll start with Manna at her hand up first. So, Manna.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank the consultants for a very educational presentation. You know, for somebody who's not an expert in finance, it was very accessible. I thought they were really good ideas, and I learned a lot. That said, there was a great deal of reference to COVID, a national pandemic that certainly affects Ulster County and New York State. There was absolutely no reference or recognition to the other crisis, that is the global climate crisis, or the fact that New York State has a very strict climate law about that addresses the need to generate renewable energy and to reduce emissions. In this day and age, I find that a really striking lack, a deficit. And it comes from separating finances and economics from the environment as if it wasn't in the context of the environment. And to me, that significantly reduces the credibility. Not to say that I did, as I said earlier, I did learn a lot. And I think in terms of conventional financial analyses, you did a good job. But to mention COVID and not mention the global climate crisis or the New York State climate law is, you know, really makes me question your overall credibility. And I say that in blunt terms, because I think moving forward, I will be recommending that purchasing include those critical elements in the RFP that seeks a consultant to do this work. Do you have the closest thing that you came to recognizing the global climate crisis and what impacts it is likely to have on Ulster County is mentioning the ARPA projects that do absolutely include that. But do you have any comments? Did I miss here? Will you consider including this in analyses moving forward?
Well, our job was to look at the existing budget and go through the existing budget and do an analysis. If there was anything in the budget that had to do with any mitigation of the impact of global warming or the environment, it's certainly something we would have commented on and measured and analyzed. If you want us to look at that, to analyze the budget and say this was missing and should be included, it would have to be based on a study that says what the county should be doing, and then we could measure it. And that's the only reason why you don't see it. The ARPA funds, it's addressing some of the climate impacts and a consultant is hired, they should definitely look at that. But there was nothing in there in the budget that we could have commented on, or analyzed as a financial impact. So that's why, it just wasn't in our scope. But if you want to include it in this scope or in a future scope, it's certainly something we would look at. It's something we all personally care about. So that's the only reason why you don't see it. James, do you have anything to add?
Jonathan?
No, we are your consultants, you know, through the adoption of the budget. So to the extent that you would like information on or details on some of those areas, we would be more than happy to, you know, to kind of delve into some of those for you.
I mean, the document itself, does have, in terms of findings, recommendations, we do talk about the need to hire an energy consultant for the town. We do talk about it in the document about seeking out grant money and working with state organizations like NYSERDA to obtain money from the state, which is available, hiring someone who would be the point person for the county and dealing with those issues. That is in this report. And I think there's also a reference in the section on fund balance, which we say that it's important to maintain a fund balance at a certain level in order to deal with crises. And one of them related to climate change and the storms and the kind of damage those storms can do, to property, both public and private. So, in that way, we do address global warming and climate change in the report. But like Margaret said, there's nothing in the budget directly that we could go to and analyze based on what the engagement was, the parameters of the engagement. So,
I think I would question that in that, for example, there is a new hire in the Department of Environment that is going to be working with businesses, but a comment, a recommendation might be to point out what a small part of the budget that is. It's not non-existent, but given the state law, not just, Legislator Green complaining about the environment all the time, but this is a state law that we're all going to have to contribute to the success of. It's very timely, it's very important, and very neglected in this report. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you to our consultants, Amber and Natalie and the staff and everyone for all your work. I just had a quick question going back to the occupancy fee. You know, the biggest thing, and this is a discussion we've been having amongst ourselves as legislators, especially upon entering in the contract with Airbnb, which I think was an important step. But one of the things that we want to do, and I think I don't want to speak for all legislators, but I think there's a consensus that we want to work also with our partners in the Lodging Coalition and our businesses in terms of raising that fee, because as you said, we are significantly lower, almost half of some of our neighboring counties in the Hudson Valley. It's even a bigger divide if you go up to the Adirondacks looking at some of the numbers, which is obviously, you know, relies on their tourist economy very crucially as well. So, but, you know, in working with the Lodging Coalition and the community, you know, based on your experiences, or do you have any reference points or information that you might be able to provide us when you've, and obviously we have to go to the state for a home rule on this, but if it was to be increased, have you, do you have any numbers or data or information from yourselves, personal experience with clients or outside in terms of research that shows the impact of raising that occupancy fee on the level of tourism? You know, again, this is a, we know this is a fee not paid by our residents, but those coming in. Is there any information or knowledge that you all have, institutional or academic, of any impact on the tourism economy once that fee is raised? And then I just have a quick two follow-ups.
James, I can give you a little bit of information because, you know, I was the finance commissioner in a resort area, on Eastern Long Island, and I was also on the town board there, and I can tell you that what we've found, and again, I don't have any empirical data, something I would probably have to research, but as hotel motel tax was raised over time, it really never had an impact on occupancy. The things that had impact on occupancy was more the, you know, the economy at that particular point in time, weather, things like that, things not related. A 2% raise in the occupancy tax, I don't think, based on what I've seen on Eastern Long Island, is going to have a negative impact on people's desire to come in and spend time in your hotels and motels and rent apartments and be tourists. So like I said in my presentation, I think the only thing, the only impact it's going to have is that you're going to collect more revenue, than you would have otherwise. Because there are the other factors are the things that really impact, demand. And that is, you know, that is, the economy, weather, you know, how well the town does keeping the area attractive, and tourist friendly. So, again, I don't have any empirical data, but over time, you know, I've never seen it negatively impact, a resort area, at least a resort area that I was familiar with.
Thank you. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, just one quick follow up. In another conversations we've had as a legislature, amongst colleagues is the direction of said revenue for the occupancy fee. You know, currently, obviously, it states how it's spent in our home rule request to the state that's been approved, but there's also been discussions, for example, of a competitive grant option for local municipalities for something that revenue who are incurring some of the costs, like, you know, for parking lots and things like that. Or, you know, another great and something I believe in is, you know, towards, you know, affordable housing efforts. So if you, can you just state, you know, do you have any recommendations on how we direct revenue? You know, I think you said $3 to $4 million potentially with a 2% increase. But do you have any recommendations on that front in terms of actually directing the revenue?
Jay, I mean, I'm not sure I understand the question exactly. In terms of how would you use the additional revenue that's collected?
Yeah. Well, currently, we direct our revenue back towards
right. The
tourism.
Right.
So there's been suggestions of, like I said, a competitive grant process for municipalities, directing it towards affordable housing, you know, different, you know, options instead of just, or, you know, especially avoiding keeping it, you know, just going to a general fund.
But I think that's more of a policy, I think. And I think that would be out of their preview because it's more of a policy, you know what I mean?
That's fair. I was just curious if, because it is, again, additional revenue.
Well, I mean, what you would want to do I think the chairman is absolutely correct that it's a policy decision that the legislature would make. But what I would advise is probably establishing some kind of a committee or working group. Again, not to spend years and years on developing a plan, but coming up with some kind of list of priorities as to what would best, how that money could best be spent and help the tourist industry. And that committee probably would have, you know, members of the legislature, some of your department people, and certainly people from the industry, and come up with a list, a priority list of how you would want to spend that money. That would be my recommendation. I think you have to get everybody involved, but the ultimate decision would be left to the legislature.
Thank you.
More questions, Jonathan?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. Legislator Cahill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for a great presentation. I just got a couple of real quick questions, and of course, we're going to be talking about the hotel motel tax a little bit. So, my question is, so we have established that we're about half of the market rate in our region. Is that what that's based on, or is that based on a more wider sample, or is it just like in the Hudson Valley or something like that?
Statewide.
That's statewide. Okay, great. Thank you very much. And the other thing, you recommended increasing the mortgage and transfer tax, right? And so, again, I'm going to ask a very similar question. How is Ulster County's mortgage and transfer tax rate compared to other counties in the region? Have you guys done that analysis at all?
We could provide you certainly with, kind of a breakdown. Maybe that would be helpful just to give you, you know, kind of a benchmark analysis specifically on that. And I think you looked at it a little bit. We could give you a breakdown of that would, you know, kind of show you either just mid-Hudson counties, that's probably most applicable, or, you know, with that too, we may be able to expand it out a little bit as well.
Yeah, because I think, you know, both of those things are a constant. I was in the legislature 10 years ago, and I'm back again. And the same discussions we have year after year after year. And, you know, as time goes on, we've left, you know, tens of millions of dollars on the table compared to our neighboring counties. Right. So I think that, you know,
well, I think you have a comptroller's report that looked at this. And I think the comptroller's in on this meeting that estimated anywhere from like $3.5 million to $6 million of potential revenue here.
Right.
As far as your transfer tax goes. I think the transfer tax, I did some research. I think in committee, it's been discussed as recently maybe as March or April.
Right.
I think you have something drafted looking at 50 cents per $500 of property transfer. Is that right?
It was something like that.
I would imagine that transfer tax would be used for probably land preservation, water preservation. I know that the state legislature just adopted a law and the governor signed it. And again, you know, I'm from Long Island, from the east end of Long Island, where the five east end towns are actually, in addition to their property transfer tax, well, in addition to the transfer tax for open space and water preservation, they're now going to impose a little bit extra, and that money is going to be used for affordable housing.
Right.
Which, is really a great thing because affordable housing, workforce housing is something that's very needed in this area. And based on our interviews with department heads, I believe it's something that you know, that you guys are very interested in also there, affordable housing, housing for local people, housing for local workers. So, you know, the transfer tax, you know, I think this new law has shown that it can be used for, it can be done and be used for multiple things. And this new law that I know that's going to be, they have to go to referendum now, but the law has been passed. I think it's going to be a great thing for affordable housing on the east end of Long Island. So that's another thing. And that's in, I think we have that in the report. So it's something to look at and consider. But, you know, I agree with you. I think it's something you guys should really look at. I think there's a lot of money there to be had. And in that chart that we did, the net effect of the recommendations and the findings, that, and again, we're relying on the controller's, I think, estimate of what the potential revenue is. But it looks like it's a pretty good number, and it's a large amount of money. You're right.
Thank you.
When conducting these reports, you know, when we're looking at, you know, mortgage tax, transfer tax, things like that, you know, our goal is to, you know, we want to make sure that the budget is, you know, structurally balanced and sound, you know, long term. So when we see a recurring source of revenue like one of those things, it seems to be out of market rate. You know, that's why we want to make sure that, you know, we're bringing it to your attention, because that, you know, looking at those, you know, items, those, again, recurring revenue sources is a key thing for that structural alignment.
Right. Ulster County doesn't have to be the Sam's Club of the region, right? We don't have to be the cheapest place to live in the region all the time, right? So my last question is on that very chart that you just mentioned, and it's on the sales tax revenue, recommending that we decrease it by $4 million. And I know that, you know, it's a post-pandemic bubble, I'm going to guess, has something to do with it. But our sales tax revenue has been terrific, and it's going up and up and up. And so is that a typical conservative approach that you folks take to a non-guaranteed recurring source of revenue when you look at that? Is that basically how you approach that?
I think you need to go back and, yeah, you need to go back and look over time. You know, and again, if you go back and look at your the actual sales tax realized over the last 10 years, you'll see that to, you know, a 20% jump in 1 year, you've never done that historically, ever. And the most you've ever collected was $127 million. And that happened a couple of times, but your yearly increases, I went back and looked, and I don't think you've had a yearly increase of more than 6%, you know, year to year over the last 10 years. So that right away, that raises a red flag. Now, you're right. Your collections over the last several months have been pretty good, but a little up and down. July was up, August came down below July, and in September spiked back up again. And I think if you read the report, you'll see, I think we did an extensive literature search, and you can see there are a lot of opinions out there that are saying that the economy could slow some. And, you know, we certainly are having problems with supply chain issues. So product may not even be there to buy. I think to put all your eggs in the basket of the last 3 months is a dangerous thing. Okay. Because I think what you said originally about the bubble, I think there's also a bubble. People have been pent up for a year, and all of a sudden now they can get out. That initial spike, I think you saw that initial spike in August and September. You're probably going to see some pullback now. Again, another uncertainty introduced into the formula here. So, you know, we're not saying that, you know, you shouldn't increase the projection, but to go from, you know, 120 million. And again, you know, you're probably going to collect more than that. You are going to collect more than that this year, a substantial amount more. But to go to 143, maybe wiser to go to 140, 141, just to, you know, because if you don't get it, you're going to have to dip in the fund balance. And then now you're lowering your fund balance, and that takes away from your rainy day fund. So if you have some kind of reduction in state aid or federal aid, all of a sudden now your situation is compounded and made even worse. So
the dominoes. Again, yep. Gotcha. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You gave me a little laugh there, Brian, because we've been talking about that for over 20 years with both the occupancy tax and a transfer tax. And it seems like even after a 35% tax increase, we still weren't able to get the guts to go in and actually do increase the occupancy tax. But anyway, all right, Legislator Bartels.
Thank you. Thank you. And Legislator Cahill touched on some of my questions because I really did want to focus on the sales tax estimates. So just to be clear, you said that in looking back, the 6% was generally the highest increase on a year-over-year basis in terms of the sales tax revenue estimates. And this year, we're proposing, the budget's proposing a 19% increase.
Correct.
So your suggestion is to pull that back somewhere in the range of, you said, $3 to $4 million. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, yes. Okay.
And again, that would come obviously with some necessary cuts in the budget in order to create the same balance, because the revenue, right, without, correct, that attendant revenue, we would need to make up for that as well.
Correct.
Do we know, and this is maybe not a question for the analyst forever, but what are we on track in terms of the sales tax revenues for 2021? What are we on track to receive? Do we have any sense of where we are right now?
Art said yesterday that he was going to collect probably the 143 this year. I believe that's what he said. Didn't he, March?
He said that, yes.
Okay.
Right now, we're at 89% of the adopted budget.
Right now at 89%. Okay.
And what's that? What date is that through, Amber?
Through 10/31, and I ran that report on the first of the month, or the second.
And Bert is saying that he's confident that we're going to bring in the 143 this year, and then he's banking on a repeat of that for next year.
He said we're going, that's basically what he said yesterday when we had the executive oversight of it, and I asked the question, and that's basically what Bert said yesterday.
Okay. I mean, this, I just have to say, for me, this gives me pause. I mean, this is something I think that we really need to consider, having a 20% or a near 20% increase in an estimate, and accepting it as an ongoing condition, given everything that we're seeing out there, not the least of which is chain supply demand problems. I mean, I think we need to take this suggestion very seriously.
You raise a good point. You just raised another really excellent point, and that is, once you increase it by that much in 1 year, what do you do the next year? If you don't meet it next year, you know, in 2022, what happens in 2023 when you do your budget? You're going to have to reduce it back down again, which means you're going to have to come up with that lost amount somewhere in your budget to keep it balanced. So you raise a really good point. You know, once you increase it by that much in 1 year, if you're wrong, it creates a real problem down the road, because
it's
now
not
you're
sustainable.
Correct.
And I also just want to, I mean, I think we all know this very well, but something that I'm thinking about in terms of the jump in sales tax revenue, you know, it was such an unusual year. We had people really stuck home, so spending their money at home. We also had stimulus checks coming in, and, you know, neither of those things are going to stay static. We know that to be true. So, you know, I think that, you know, when you take all factors into consideration, looking at what our constituents and the county is facing, I'm taking your recommendation very seriously.
Yeah. And the other legislator who was just on before you, you know, when he had mentioned the bubble, and I think you just kind of alluded to that. People have been pent up for a year, and, you know, when they were able to get out, you had that big surge, that big spike right at the beginning. And I think that showed up in August and September, and in all likelihood is going to be a little bit of a pullback. So, you know, I don't, the September number was a big number for the county. but I don't think that that September number is going to be repeated. Again, I may be wrong, and I hope for the county's sake I am wrong. But again, are you willing to risk it, you know, risk being short next year based on a couple of good months this year? And with all the other uncertainties, you know, we're trying to give you the best advice we can.
I think in this context, too, you should also consider the expenditure side of things. If you look at 2020 in the variance numbers, we'd indicated there was a significant positive variance on the expenditure side. And a lot of that probably resulted from expenditures that the county didn't incur as a result of pandemic. Now, we know that those expenditures, when we return to normalcy, are going to go, you know, right back up. So, you know, when thinking about sales tax, we don't want to see in a position again where those expenditures come back up and you're severely under budgeted, because then, you know, it's out of line.
But you also, James, that you didn't mention, Tracy, was also the idea that, you know, people were collecting, a lot of people were on unemployment and collecting the extra $600 or something like that a week. And that's not there anymore. So,
correct.
Oh, that's another part of the picture that, you know, lending to what you were talking about, you know, the idea that, you know, stimulus checks.
Yeah. That's a good point. And James's point that he just made, you know, I think when we did our departmental interviews, a number of the department heads actually acknowledged the fact that, you know, some of their expenditures were down this year because of COVID, because, you know, they weren't doing certain things. I mean, child care was one big line. I mean, one of the reasons why the fund balance went up in 2020, I think, or not this year, but last year in 2020, was because expenses were down big in some areas like child care, because all the kids were home. So you didn't need to spend child care money that was budgeted for. So, like James said, you know, those expenses are going to come back. So you have to be real careful.
JC, do you have any more?
No, that was my main. Thank you.
Anybody, before I call on you, Lynn, is there anyone else that wants to, that hasn't asked a question yet? If I don't see you, just speak up. No? Okay. Yeah. Heidi?
No. Oh, sorry.
No,
I don't know how I got unmuted.
No problem. Then I'll get, go ahead, Lynn.
And no, I was just going to add to the conversation with regards to the sales tax. We saw a big uptick last year in building supplies, a lot of building. But right now we're seeing a lot of buildings around the community. And I'm going to all the different towns, things that were started to be built and that are sitting there waiting for supplies that aren't coming in. Backlog supplies, we've got the same thing on cars, which is also a big sales tax revenue generator for us. I think we're going to see a dip in cars going into next year. So, you know, just along the lines of what everyone's saying, I think we're seeing things already that are indicating we may have some problems down the road.
Yes, and if you go out to the car dealers, like for instance, the Honda dealer, they used to have, I mean, a huge parking lot was full of cars. Now there's not even half the number of cars, and probably about one third that they normally would keep on the lot. So you're right, Lynn. Al?
Yeah, to add to that, I could tell you from family, my son-in-law is a car dealer, and they have no new cars. None.
I can add to that. A friend of mine, his lease was up on a Toyota, and he went to get a new car, and they basically told him, we're going to extend your lease for 6 months because we have no cars. And lumber's gone up almost 30-40%. So people are hesitating now to do improvements. So exactly. I think we have to be cautious.
Right. Well, I think the lumber is starting to come down, but Brian?
Thank you very much, Chairman. So I want to really quickly talk about the 59 additional positions in the budget. You know, obviously new positions have a really long-term negative effect on our expenditures, right? I mean, not that we don't need to have people working. Of course we do, but you know, that seems like a large number in one budget. I know you guys looked at that. Did you look at the department specifically and percentages of increase in each department or anything like that? I just want to give you guys, we just got this report an hour ago, so you know, a little bit before the meeting, so we really haven't had a chance to go through it. So I'm sorry for questions that may be obviously answered in the report. I apologize ahead of time for that. Yeah.
There is a table in the report, I mean, which breaks down the positions by department, you know, by position title. And I think we had, like, was it regular pay? I think we had in there, Len.
Yeah, we looked at regular pay. Well, the way it's budgeted for this year.
For this year, correct.
But one of the, you know, in the report, we do look at, and I think it was during, it was mentioned in the presentation also when James presented expenditures. 59, you're right. It's a lot in 1 year. Now we did the departmental interviews, and obviously the departments that are getting new people, you know, everybody claims they need, you know, they need the people. Well, and so, you know, my experience shows me that that's always the case. So, you know, there are a couple of departments where there's, you know, 5, 6, 7 additions. I think what needs to be done is 59 in 1 year. We came to the conclusion, even with the express need by the department heads, 59 at one time is a little bit much, maybe a little bit too heavy to absorb in 1 year. And maybe it needs to be spread out over several years. Again, we came up with, you know, again, a kind of an estimate. If you figure $50,000 for a position and $25,000 for benefits, that's $75,000 a year per position. So if you can trim that down by 10 or 15 slots or even more, you know, you're going to save a substantial amount of money. Then you hire the new people that you prioritize. And I think that's the way we put it in the recommendation, that people that are new positions that are deemed to be of high priority should be looked at first, and perhaps some kind of gradual increase could be done, you know, measuring the impact on the finances and impact on operations. You know, do you really need those extra 2 or 3 people next year? Or maybe not. But certainly do it more gradually than 59 in 1 year. I know that the executive branch says that, well, we're trying to get back to 2019 levels. I think in the report last year, we said that, well, you know, this may be an opportunity to make some cuts and reduce your overall staffing moving forward. So if the idea now is to get back to 219, you really didn't take advantage of any cutbacks or, you know, that you made last year through the retirement incentive or not filling positions that were open. So, again, we do address it, and we do say that maybe some kind of priority should be applied to these positions, and you know, and maybe 59 shouldn't be hired. Maybe it should be done a little more slowly. Don't you? That's basically what we have in the report, right, James? I mean, can you think of anything else?
No.
So yeah, I think it's something you should look at as a legislature and ask maybe for some kind of priority as to, you know, how many of these are really essential for next year. And I think that's the way we put it in the recommendation.
Thank you.
Dave, you're on mute.
Sorry about that. I was calling on you, Legislator Bartels. I saw your hand up, and then Legislator Cahill also.
Well, thank you, Chair. So on the subject of the positions, was any analysis done to determine whether or not those positions, the positions that are being requested, are filling positions, old positions that were incentivized in anticipation of a difficult time, or are they totally new positions or both? Or was the analysis not yet done?
We didn't summarize it. I think if you go through the departmental write-ups, I think they're covered in the departmental write-ups where we were told, you know, it was to fill a, because you can't tell by just looking, you know, you have to kind of get behind the positions. So we did get it through the interviews, but we, you know, we did not aggregate it.
Okay.
So my answer to that is some of them are positions that, you know, that were there previously, and they either eliminated the position last year and they're bringing it back. And then, of course, there are some new ones.
So again, just to out loud to my colleagues, I think, I think one that the suggestion to request a prioritization is a good suggestion, but I also think that we should internally do that analysis to be able to see in an aggregated form, you know, which positions are backfilling previous positions that we may or may not have understood to be temporarily removed or deleted in anticipation of difficult financial times, and which are totally brand new positions. Because as you say, sometimes that's not always so easy to tell, particularly if there's been a title change or a deletion. So
they were listed on page 38.
Yeah.
If you haven't looked at that.
I haven't. We just got this.
Yeah, they're listed on 38. I know it starts out with the TA that we just, in other words, we okayed those people that were needed in the DA's office.
Yeah, page 38 is a listing of all the positions with their salaries and departments. And I think the number is like 17 of those positions are partially or fully funded through, you know, outside funding. Which is again a whole nother issue, because the question then becomes how long does that funding last, and what do you do when the funding goes away?
To interrupt, but the listing, I just was able to pull it up very quickly. I'm grateful for the listing, but the listing is just a straight listing. It doesn't compare it to 19 and 20, which would be helpful. And I know something that our own financial analysts could do pretty easily and quickly, to put more work.
Which they have, Tracy, by the way. They have. They sent an analysis out on the personnel stuff. I don't know when it originally went out, but
I actually know you're absolutely right. We have that. We didn't put it in the report. I guess we could have. We could add it if you know. We could add the report and source it to to your staff. But you're right. That was done.
Okay.
There is a breakdown. Thank you for reminding us. I'm sorry. We did get that. I do have it right here. So
yeah, Amber, if you want, or the chairman, either one, we could add that to the report. That's not a problem.
Thank you.
Senator Bartel, do you have any more? Okay, then I think it was Kayo.
I'm good, Dave. That was my previous hand up.
All right, but I have a question on the they have the three positions that you saw that are listed for the ARP people that, you know, on the executive felt that this was the best way of doing it, and that was basically, you know, what we ended up going along with. Now, you see the numbers on that. And the three people, do you think that that's a reasonable way of going about doing this? Or do you think it would be better off the money being used? And I realize that, you know, it's kind of a catch-22 for you to ask this because you're consultants, obviously. So, you know, it's like, you know, what do you, when you ask a surgeon how to do something, they'll tell you to cut it. So anyway, what is your opinion on that and the numbers when it, you know, with the salaries that are in that? I guess James or Len?
James and I actually discussed this yesterday, so I'm going to let him answer this one.
I mean, I everybody's handling it differently. I think, you know, we'd indicated that before. You know, these are going to, this is a complex program. So, you know, to find people that are capable of, you know, kind of doing this work may be difficult. The timing constraints around this are also something that needs to be considered. You know, what's the time frame for bringing these folks in? Because you need to have people on staff now before these funds start, you know, really being spent to ensure that they're going, you know, kind of, you know, down the correct path, the right path. You know, we're not saying that, you know, that these positions, you know, shouldn't necessarily be brought in, but they should also maybe be sourced to other areas as well. You know, perhaps you bring in one of these folks as a grants coordinator. And I do think there's a recommendation in the report to bring in a grants coordinator, because outside of ARPA alone, there's other federal funds, you know, that are available. And it's interesting. I actually participated in a webinar a couple days ago. And I think it was the U.S. Conference of Mayors, maybe. I don't recall which association had put it on, but it was discussing, you know, a lot of these federal agencies also got, you know, a lot of funding through this. And there's, outside of ARPA, there's other areas, you know, that could be investigated. So if you have, you know, grants coordinator primarily looking at ARPA, you know, maybe they could be looking at some of these other areas as well. I think USDA has funding that, you know, that they're putting out and making available. And there's a whole bunch of other sources. And, you know, to the extent that, you know, you have somebody that brings in even a $100,000 grant that the county otherwise wouldn't have had. I mean, they're covering their salary. So, you know, perhaps expanding that role, you know, could be a positive thing. You know, three positions, you know, it does, you know, seem like it could be a lot. You know, back to the question about consulting. And consultants, you know, I think one of the benefits again there is, you know, bringing in consultants, you're not, you know, I'd mentioned this before, but you're not limited to, you know, putting the blinders on and kind of just looking, you know, within your own jurisdiction. You kind of get the ability to see what other folks are doing. And I think that's an important component of ARPA, is understanding everybody's approach, because all those approaches are different. And if you can see, you know, what municipalities are, you know, kind of moving in the same like path, then, you know, that likely means that it's probably the right approach. And I think that's, you know, that can certainly be a positive thing as well.
I don't also know. There's an end date to this program. So by 2026, if you haven't spent the money, it's going back. What do you do with those three positions?
Yes. And I think, you know, in our conversation yesterday, Bert had mentioned that there may be a sunset clause around this, but you're also going to be bringing people that are, you know, that may be aware that this could be a temporary role for them, because once these funds are no longer available, then, you know, that position could be gone.
And I think just to add to that, I believe yesterday was also determined that these three people have not been hired yet. So the question becomes, what is the pool? And again, James explained how technical this is and how complicated it is. And so you really need someone to come on pretty quick that already has a really good understanding and knowledge of ARPA. My guess is most of those people have already been gobbled up by other jurisdictions. So the question is, who are you going to hire at this point to come in with the kind of expertise you need to hit the ground running? So, you know, then you may find someone, but then again, you may not. So certainly the alternative to hire, and I'm not saying that it should be, you know, one firm as opposed to another, but the question becomes, who's out, you know, what's the pool of available people that have the kind of expertise you really want them to have at this point, with the program already started. Another thing, that's another thing to consider. But I think James's idea that if you do, you know, three too many? I don't know. I mean, it seems like what they've done here is set up an organization structure, because if you look at the three positions, and the titles, it's really a little unit that they're setting up with, you know, a supervisor and then someone, you know, just below them that does certain technical work, and then a support person. Now, do you need all of that? I don't know. And like Margaret said, what's going to happen in a couple of years when the money's not there? I know there's a sunset provision, but are you really going to fire these people? Or are you going to keep them on, and what are they going to do? Hiring maybe someone who's really knowledgeable on grants that could really learn ARPA quickly, who then could work for the county after that, securing additional money. Like James said, it only takes like one grant a year for that type of position to pay itself. So, you know, that may be the alternative, to look for that one good person that you hire full time and long time, and have that person be your coordinator. You know, you have some, you know, again, you already have these three positions in the budget. They're funded by ARPA. But again, who are you going to get at this point? I mean, I would have hoped to see these positions filled already. So just another, just some other thoughts.
Senator Bartels.
Well, I was just wondering, in speaking about those positions and your thoughts on those positions, if you had read the job descriptions as they were presented to the legislature and posted, or if you were speaking just generally in terms of
speaking generally, but those positions, I mean, I've supervised the HR as being a finance commissioner, and those, you know, again, those are pretty general titles. Yeah. I don't know how specific the job descriptions were that went out. And
I mean, I can say that, and maybe we should get them to you if we could do that, because, you know, the job descriptions were fairly detailed, but the kinds of work that you're describing, I don't know that they would even fully cover. You know what I mean? They were not specifically grant writers. They were not, specifically financial people.
I think it's more like
project managers is kind of your description of that is, I think we're pretty close to hiring them. They definitely do have sunsets.
Well, in the resolution. Right.
Let us look at them, being that this is the work we do, so we can look at those job descriptions and that make sure they're going to work for you. We don't mind doing that. Send them to us.
And we do have other clients that have hired folks, you know, for this purpose. So, you know, we could certainly reach out to them and see if they have job descriptions, and, you know, perhaps we could kind of benchmark and see how the two compare.
Yeah,
that
I
would
think
be fantastic. Thank you.
I think the grants analyst idea is kind of, you know, we understand the fact that if you went that route, the person you hire would have the grants background, but those types of, quite frankly, those types of people are usually pretty good at dealing with something like ARPA. I mean, they do have those kind of skills, but we do realize that they would have, that person would probably not have one of these three titles. That person would have a different title, and there'd be a different process. It's just a different tack to take. And again, when you read the report, you'll see how we lay it out. And I think it's pretty clear that it would be a different way to approach this than hiring three people and creating a unit.
Do I have anyone else that has any questions? None of the legislators? Does the comptroller have any questions?
No, thank you.
Does Alicia have any questions? Okay.
Good, thank you.
I don't see anyone else. Anybody else yell out? I don't see any hands.
For adjournment.
Alrighty, and then I'd make a dip. You had a motion for the adjournment from Legislator Litz, seconded by?
Second.
Legislator Cahill, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right.
Good night, everybody. Be safe. Stay healthy.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Everyone be healthy.
You.
Good night.